This is only one win for us. We done lost hundreds. We still got another young boy out in Minnesota who got killed. And the cop claimed that it was a taser. But let's just take it one day at a time right now and be happy that we accomplished something where we could be heard and we could be seen. And just everybody just get along together.
South LA resident Raymond Ross yesterday afternoon reacting to the conviction of former Minneapolis police officer Derek Chauvin for murdering George Floyd. Ross also referenced the police killing of Dante Wright in Brooklyn Center, Minnesota, and echoed the famous words of Rodney King there when he said, "Just everybody get along together." He was standing at the intersection of Florence and Normandy, the epicenter of the violent 1992 LA uprising, after white officers were found not guilty for the beating of Rodney King.
Oh, that was a hell of a day that day. This is a whole different scene right here. This is a scene of joy and celebration that the law was on our side for once.
The Chauvin verdict was met with tears, with relief. Also caution across the country and here in L.A. South L.A. resident Celia Rivera said yesterday wasn't a celebration because it was still clouded by the trauma of why we were here in the first place.
One moment of accountability, because it's not justice, one moment of accountability does not make up for the centuries-long violence. It is a drop into the ocean.
In Minnesota, George Floyd's younger brother, Philonis Floyd, said his sibling's death sparked a worldwide movement.
I get calls, I get DMs, people from Brazil, from Ghana, from Germany, everybody, London, Italy, they're all saying the same thing. We won't be able to breathe until you're able to breathe.
That's right.
Today, we are able to breathe again.
But just moments before the verdict was announced yesterday, police in Columbus, Ohio, shot and killed a 16-year-old black girl. Her name, Makaia Bryant. California Congresswoman Karen Bass called police killings the human rights issue in the country.
We saw the videotape. We understand the egregious murder, but what about the ones that were not taped on a cell phone? So today I am relieved, today I exhale, but today just marks the beginning of a new phase of a long struggle to bring justice in America.
And she urged the Senate to pass the House-passed George Floyd Justice in Policing Act. So what happens now? We're going to put that question to two guests. Cheryl Dorsey is a retired LAPD sergeant and author of the book Black and Blue, The Creation of a Social Advocate. Welcome back.
Thank you.
Also joining us is USC law professor Jody Armour. Welcome back to the program, Jody.
Great to be back with you, man.
Great to have you back. All right. So what, just give me a reaction. Did you expect Chauvin to be found guilty on all three counts?
Okay. So no, I didn't. I thought there was so much subterfuge and so many distractions thrown out by the defense. I figured that there would be one juror who might be like-minded and hang this thing up. But, you know, I don't want to celebrate because a man lost his life and never to return to his family. But I am pleased that the jurors believed what they heard from the chief of police, his commander, his training officer, as well as the first sergeant on scene, that we don't teach our officers to conduct and comport themselves that way. This was something improvised. And while I appreciate their honesty and their candor, listen, they don't really get a whole lot of brownie points because, after all, Chauvin had 22 personnel complaints and he had only ever been disciplined once over his 19-year career. So there's much more that needs to be done on that department and nationally across the 18,000 departments that we have here in the U.S.
Hmm. Jody, before we get into that, what needs to happen next, I just want to get your reaction to the verdict.
Madeline, I didn't feel an eruption of joy, but more somber and stunned satisfaction, I suppose. The kind of relief you might feel when a meteor that was coming perilously close to the earth missed us. You know, there was something calamitous that could have happened if we collectively sat back and watched that 9 minutes and 29 seconds of video and said to ourselves through our jury system that there was nothing criminally wrong done there. He didn't cross any line. We've seen that happen before here in L.A. The first Rodney King video seemed to give knockdown ocular proof of wrongdoing, yet the Simi Valley jury acquitted the four officers after they looked at that tape frame by frame, in the same way this defense counsel went to the Floyd tape frame by frame. That's what the defense counsel did when it came to the officers accused of beating Rodney King, and it prevailed there. It worked there. So I think there was the bated breath that we were all waiting with. You know, remember Walter Scott. He was shot six times in the back on video, and the first jury deadlocked on that. So there was a sense of relief I had more than anything else, or more somber and stunned satisfaction.
Right. How different is the United States, how different is L.A. from 1992, Jody?
Radically different, Madeline. Listen, we were at the forefront in California of the three strikes approach to crime and punishment. Retribution, retaliation, and revenge is how we looked at social justice issues, crime issues. We have gone through a period now, the result of the protests in the streets over the summer, when they were roiling here in L.A. alone 6 weeks in a row, day in and day out. As a result of that, voters went to the ballot boxes and brought in a progressive prosecutor, made the top cop in L.A. County, George Gascon, a progressive prosecutor, and passed Measure J, which takes 10% of the county funds, unrestricted funds, up to $1 billion a year, and dedicates it to incarceration alternatives. So we're at a very different place now than we were after 92, after the riots in L.A.
Cheryl, what about inside the LAPD? How different is it today?
I'm not certain that it's very different in terms of, you know, the system does what it's designed to do, and you know, we have errant officers still on the Los Angeles Police Department who are living to offend again, who are enjoying the shelter and cover of the Los Angeles Police Protective League, our union. Our chief sometimes minimizes and mitigates bad behavior. We know that in the midst of this George Floyd situation, there were memes that were sent out by someone on the LAPD saying, "For Valentine's Day, I can't breathe, or you take my breath away," something that was offensive and further dehumanizing Mr. Floyd. And so because personnel complaints are confidential, we don't often hear what happens. If anything, the police chief has tremendous autonomy. The police commission can make a recommendation for discipline, and then the chief does what he wants. And so I don't think day to day for ground pounders like me, street troopers, what happened in Minneapolis is going to much change what happened on the LAPD or other departments.
Really? You don't think that there's going to be renewed interest in police reform? Because after, you know, in the last year, more than 30 states have passed police reform bills. But are you saying that they kind of don't lack teeth?
Well, listen, I mean, they're going to say that because it sounds sexy when they're standing in front of a bank of cameras. But what they say and what they do are two completely different things. And I mean, let's take a look right next door with the L.A. County Sheriff's Department, where you have 17 internal gangs within that department. And it's not like Sheriff Alex Villanueva doesn't know about the executioners and the Vikings and the regulators and the jump off boys who all go out and get tatted up and have celebratory barbecues when they kill folks or maim people in South Central Los Angeles. And so the fish rots from the head. And while there may be some, you know, giant, some baby steps going forward, there's still much to be done. Many families across the nation are waiting for that same justice and accountability. In Connecticut, Mubarak Suleiman, just the other day, Jacob Blake shot in the back and paralyzed in Kenosha, Wisconsin. I guess if you don't kill a black man, it's all good because the officer got his job back. So I'm not encouraged.
Yeah. Jody, Mayor Garcetti has released his proposed budget. It calls for slightly higher spending on police than last year, about a 3% increase. And he says that's because crime is up. So what do you make of that? What do you make of the fact that there was so much talk about, quote unquote, defunding the police or redirecting the resources in the wake of George Floyd's killing initially and during the protests over the summer? And yet you see the budget actually increased.
The resolve isn't there. You know, we're seeing that there really is a stronghold that law enforcement has on municipal governments across the nation, and this one here in LA as well. And, you know, we're told now that crime has gone up because of the pandemic stresses, et cetera, that we need more police to do what? Police aren't solving a lot of crimes, right? We're finding that the clearance rate in many cities for violent crimes like homicides under 40, 30, 35%. For rates, it's under 20%. You know, police aren't very effective at really solving what we really want to be solved, violent and serious crimes. And then they say, but you just need more of us, and that will somehow magically affect the crime rate. The criminology studies just don't support that kind of logic, and that's the kind of logic we have to reconsider now. And mayors are going to have to, in the future, start reckoning with the police unions and these powerful law enforcement interests if they're really going to bring about transformative justice.
Hmm. Cheryl, do you agree that there needs to be a rethinking of what the police's mission actually is in a broad sense? Like, what are the police for?
Well, I think, you know, the police departments are doing, you know, what it's designed to do. And I think it's effective in most arenas. We do have, you know, a few, and I think the few are too many that are causing problems. And so I think for me, the key is accountability. Training is not an issue. Officers pretty much know what to do. It's only when they violate that training and when police chiefs minimize and mitigate the behavior, there's not a consequence commensurate with that violation, that we continue to see the kinds of things that we do. Many times when it makes national news, these are all repeat offender officers. Walter Scott was killed by an officer in Michael Schlager who had tased someone two or three times before he ultimately killed Walter Scott. And we know in the case of Tamir Rice, what Timothy Lohman's disciplinary history or lack thereof looked like, and which is very similar to the whole Derek Chauvin. Officer Tao stood sentry. He too had been the subject of civil litigation, cost the taxpayers $25,000 in Minneapolis for hitting a man in the head with a flashlight and knocking his teeth out. So it's not like officers don't know what to do. There needs to be a consequence commensurate with their violation and misconduct.
So should they be fired if they have a certain amount of personnel complaints against them?
Well, how do you put a number on, you know, how do you quantify, you know, when an officer should be fired by number of complaints? Certainly the severity, but I know what can happen because, listen, I've seen it done personally and it was done to me. You can certainly pull somebody out of the field. It's not a right to work patrol. Every division has somebody like Chauvin who nobody wants to work with. You put him on morning watch, you put him on the desk, you put him in the kit room, you get him out of the field so that he can't hurt or harm anyone until you can either put the paperwork together to get him off the force, or you just relegate him to, he's a house mouse. and it's done, and captains know how to do it.
But then you have the situation with Dante Wright, where the officer apparently thought that she had pulled her taser and had pulled her service gun instead and shot him and killed him.
Well, that's her story, and she's going to stick to it. But listen, at 26 years on the department, I promise you, she touched that gun every day. We have to. She knew that weapon intimately. And so I find her being disingenuous and intellectually dishonest.
Jody, on the federal level, there is this George Floyd Justice in Policing Act that Karen Bass mentioned and has been passed in the House and is languishing in the Senate right now, or there's a compromise bill being worked on. Do you think that that is a solution, would go a long way to preventing some of these acts of violence in the future?
I don't know that it would have done anything to prevent what happened to either George Floyd or Dante Wright when I look at the proposals. You know, often they're focused more on individual accountability for particular officers, and that's what a lot of people felt they got out of this verdict. But that's been a concern I've had because, and a lot of activists have been pointing this out all summer and currently, that, you know, this isn't just about individual accountability. What we're really concerned with is that the system itself is problematic. There's systemic injustice in it. And this individual accountability approach gives the impression that the system can police itself, that the system corrects itself. And it can't, right? Personal accountability approaches will never solve structural problems.
Jody Armour. He's a law professor at USC. Cheryl Dorsey, retired LAPD sergeant and author of the book Black and Blue, The Creation of a Social Advocate. Thank you both very much.
Thanks very much.
Thank you.
Coming up, the percentage of black male doctors in this country, it hasn't changed since 1940, around 3%. We're going to look at why so few black men become physicians next on Press Play. This is Press Play on KCRW. I'm Madeline Brand. New research out of UCLA is confirming what many African Americans already know. There are few black doctors. Just 5% of all doctors are black. Statistically, there's been no increase in the percentage of black male doctors since 1940. And they earn, on average, about $50,000 a year less than white male doctors. Dr. Dan Lee is the author of the study and a professor of medicine at UCLA. Welcome to the program.
Hi, thank you for having me.
Great to have you. Also joining us is Dr. Deborah Prothro-Stith. She is the dean and a professor at Charles R. Drew University of Medicine and Science here in Los Angeles. And that's recognized as a historically black graduate institution by the federal government. Welcome to the program, Dr. Prothro-Stith.
Thank you very much.
It is great to have you both. And Dan, let's begin with you. You used census data. And you went back really to the beginning of the 20th century. What has changed, or what more importantly hasn't changed, since the beginning of the 20th century to now?
Yeah, I wasn't sure what I was going to find. And so I thought, I was a history major in college, and so that was one of the reasons that drew me to the study. But basically, in 1900, 1% of physicians were black, and now it's only 5% today. So that's only an increase of 4 percentage points. What was more shocking to me was that the percent of physicians who are black men is virtually, as you mentioned, virtually unchanged since 1940. It was a little under 3% in 1940, and it's a little under 3% today. And the increase since then has been an increase in black women physicians. And so it was basically 0% in 1940 and almost 3% today. That gets us to about the 5% of physicians who are black today, which is very low compared to the 13% of the U.S. population who are black.
Wow. Deborah, your reaction to these numbers?
Well, yes, this is disappointing, but not surprising, Madeline. I remember in the 1990s when the American Association of Medical Colleges initiated Project 3000 by 2000, giving 2 years to get the number of physicians, black physicians, up to 3000. And that goal was not met in 2000. It's met today, now 4 decades later. But still, it's not sufficient. As Dan said, 13% of the population and just a bit over 5% of the physicians is a problem, and not surprising given all that we know about medical school, but also professional racism in society. What's happening with the police doesn't just stay at the police. It is really all over every profession we have.
Right. And so, what is the cause of this? Dan focused specifically on black male doctors, so let's talk about them. Why is it so difficult to train, to get black men interested in a career in medicine, for them to actually succeed in becoming doctors?
Well, at Charles Drew University, we have a very good record of training black and brown physicians. We are a partner with UCLA and looking to start our own medical program where we can even increase those numbers. But roughly 25%, but of a small class of 28, is in fact black and brown male medical students. So it can be done, but it does take extra effort. And again, the George Floyd knee on the neck. If we use that metaphorically and understand that there are race-based decisions that negatively affect the Black community and Black men in particular, we just happen to know on camera what's happening with policing. And I think this period of anti-racism in the United States gives us an opportunity to really take and make some strides forward. We know some of the things that work, we just need to do them.
Mm. Well, I guess, so it starts early, right? With children, it starts in grade school.
Even before, we have a pipeline program that's now about 25 years old that starts kindergarten through 12th grade, and it focuses on STEM. And so that is a huge way of moving this ball forward. But public education has to embrace science and math and has to get better at providing adequate education for students as they enter that pipeline. One of the places that the pipeline leaks is once students enter college and say they want to be a physician. And we have been working with some of the historically Black colleges and universities to model what Xavier University in New Orleans does with its pre-medical academy, and they have tremendous success. We know you have to be intentional about this. We know you have to be anti-racist and make some affirmative decisions. And what we've learned at Charles Drew is that our students, to be successful, sometimes need, I call it a special sauce, but it's old-fashioned support for some life events like the death of a parent or financial crisis in the family. And those events can derail students, the loans that they have. So we really have to pay attention to them. And fortunately, you know, Bloomberg announced $100 million to the Black HBCU medical schools. And, you know, that just gives us a lot of hope and a lot of potential to provide scholarships for students. Like I said, we know what to do. We just need to do it.
Well, speaking of money, Dan, another thing you looked at in your research is the pay disparity between white and Black doctors. And you found that the pay gap was around $50,000. That is a huge gap. And what is the reason behind that? Is it because of different specialties that Black doctors are entering less remunerative specialties than white doctors?
Yeah, I wasn't able to examine why that, but I think that is my main hypothesis, is that a doctor is not just a doctor. Doctors train in different specialties, and unfortunately in our medical system, different specialties are compensated in different ways. And there is probably just a representation problem that Black physicians aren't represented in certain more well-compensated specialties. There was a very good editorial about this in JAMA Internal Medicine. There's a radiologist oncologist who said that he's at Johns Hopkins, who said that he's usually the only he's now an associate professor. He's not usually only the only Black physician in the room. And so there's been other studies that just show that Black physicians aren't well represented in these more well-compensated specialties. And that probably explains this huge 50,000 gap that has existed pretty much since 1960.
Wow, so that's a huge gap. And also, when you consider how expensive medical school is, I think the average
Exactly.
Wow. I mean, the average debt is what, $200,000 or something like that? I read that somewhere.
Yes.
So, Deborah, why is that? Do you have a hypothesis as to why there's that pay gap?
I think specialty does play a role in that. I think many of the students that we train are committed to serving in under-resourced communities and enter primary care. and as a result get paid less. It's part of the problem we have in medicine, that attracting primary care physicians often means trying to figure out how to help them pay back some of those loans and supplement salaries. LA Care, as a foundation, has put money in their safety net to try to help residents and junior faculty pay back their debt if they are practicing in an under-resourced, underserved community. So those are the kinds of things that can make a difference. And I think we just have to, again, look at ways to do more of that.
Well, I want to thank you both so much for coming on the show and highlighting this issue.
Thank you. This is so hugely important. Thanks, Dan, for your work.
Oh, and thank you for coming. Really appreciate your insightful comments.
That's Dr. Deborah Prothro-Stith. She's Dean and Professor at the Charles R. Drew University of Medicine and Science. And Dr. Dan Lee, author of a brand new study out of UCLA about how few Black doctors there are in the United States. He's also a professor of medicine at UCLA. Coming up, the Bosnian director of the Oscar-nominated movie Quo Vadis Aida is here to talk about how she made a war movie that's different.
Aida will allow me to show the war like I feel it, like banality of evil.
Our conversation is next on Press Play. This is Press Play on KCRW. I'm Madeline Brand. The breakup of Yugoslavia ignited a decade-long series of wars and ethnic conflicts in the Balkans. That was back in the 90s. And then in July of 1995, genocide. Around 8,000 Muslim men and boys from the town of Srebrenica were systematically murdered by Bosnian Serb forces, their bodies dumped into mass graves. It was the worst ethnic cleansing in Europe since World War II, and it forced the West to get involved to create a ceasefire. That's the subject of director Jasmila Jibanic's latest film.
You promised us that Serbs would not enter the town, that you would protect us.
I didn't promise anything. I'm doing as much as I can.
Srebrenica je zaštićena zona UN-a, vaša obaveza je zaštititi ove ljude.
Srebrenica is a UN safe zone, and your mission is to protect people.
Gdje vode ljude? Zna li ko gdje ih vode?
Where are they taking them?
The film is called Quo Vadis Aida. It's nominated for an Academy Award for Best International Feature Film. The movie is set at the UN Peacekeeping Forces headquarters in Srebrenica at an abandoned factory where residents were fleeing Bosnian Serb forces who had just taken over the city. That story is told through the eyes of a former teacher named Aida, who's working as a UN translator, translating between the residents, thousands of whom were now gathered at this factory, and the few Dutch peacekeepers running it. The film's director, Jasmila Zibanić, joins us now from Sarajevo. Welcome.
Thank you very much for inviting me.
Well, it's a great pleasure to have you. It's really an extraordinary movie that you have created. I just want to find out how you originally conceived of this movie. It is based on real life events, and how much of it that you portray, how much of it is actually what happened versus your taking some creative license?
I lived through war in Sarajevo, so war was something which I knew about. But at that time, United Nations were protecting Srebrenica, and I believed that at least that city will be saved. So when we heard in 95 that Srebrenica was taken by the Serbian army, it left me in a state of shock. This betrayal was so huge because you not only that it happens to your people, but it means that you can't believe in anything in the world. You can't believe in promises of United Nations, of all nations in the world, on human rights, that you start believing, okay, now it means that only violence is ruling this world. And that feeling, you know, didn't leave me, and I was always carrying it with me. So all of that was for me, you know, a huge trauma, like for every Bosnian. And then I thought, as a filmmaker, this is huge human drama. And I thought, I will talk about my pain, but I think it resonates with the state of the world today.
Yeah. And are you Bosnian Muslim?
My identity is very complicated because my grandparents were Muslims. We are Bosnians who, you know, Slavs who live here forever. But my parents grew up in socialism and they decided that religion is not for them. So we grew up in very secular circumstances and our family was very, very mixed. You know, I have Serbs, I have Croats, I have very religious Croats, Serbs and Muslims in the family. And that's how Bosnia was living. Nobody cared who is who until the war was prepared. You know, identity, I think it's something very old-fashioned in a way.
But it can rear its head in modern times, as we're seeing, as we saw in your movie. There are a couple of reminders in your movie that are so poignant about what you're just talking about, how everyone lived side by side, and then all of a sudden they are bitter enemies, or all of a sudden they are fighting. Aida, who's the lead character, she was a school teacher before she became a UN translator. And there's a scene where she is desperate to try to save her sons and her husband. And she comes face to face with a former student of hers who is part of the Serbian forces doing the ethnic cleansing. And it's a really poignant and scary moment.
Yeah, this is, you know, the, of course, elites constructing and leading the war and financing the war. But the people who are on the ground are people who are either forced or seduced to fight. And in Bosnia, you know, the situation was that, you know, neighbors turned against neighbors. But Sarajevo was a little bit different because we decided to keep and to stick to each other. And that's, I think, what saved Sarajevo. But in smaller towns, people were either, as I said, forced or scared enough so that they joined their own nation and their own national armies, turning against neighbors and teachers. And there were many stories where former student was torturing professor or other way around. That is sad part of war.
Yeah. Tell us about the lead character, Aida. She's a UN translator and, as I said, a former school teacher. Did you base her on a real person?
I did a lot of research, and at the end, she is creation or compilation of many stories that I heard. Because all characters in my films are female that I can identify easier with. And then I thought also people have enough films about war from male perspective. I really wanted to talk about war from female perspective, because as somebody who looked at the war, I never find any beauty in it, or I can't make aesthetics of war. I don't like that because I don't think it's true. And I thought Aida will allow me to show the war like I feel it, like banality of evil. And I wanted to have her as a translator because she was able to be at the important meetings. And for audience, I think it was very important to show both worlds.
And she is the only woman in this world, really. And you see her desperately shuttling between the UN officials, the Dutch, and her family, her two sons who are grown and or young men, and her husband, trying to keep them safe. And she's begging the Dutch to save them, to put them on the list to evacuate from this UN center where all the refugees are gathered, and the Serbs are separating the men from the women and the children. And there's a moment where the UN soldiers are telling her that her husband can stay with the peacekeeping force, be on the list, because he helped earlier with negotiations with the Serbian general, Ratko Mladic. And I just want to play a clip of Aida pleading with the Dutch leader to take her sons.
And our sons?
That's not possible.
Why is that possible? Why?
We stick to the rules here. So it's his choice. He can stay or leave.
Každa samo ti možeš ostati zato što zbio na pregovorima.
Stavite moje sinove na spisak umjesto mene.
Please, take our sons instead of him.
I made myself pretty clear here. They're not on the list.
Molim vas, stavite bar jednog sina na spisak. Molim vas, stavite bar jednog na spisak.
Please, at least put one of them on the list.
And she gets down literally on her hands and knees, begging him, and he's unmoved. Really a heartbreaking Sophie's Choice moment. Tell us about the women of Srebrenica who lost their husbands, their fathers, their sons. Does Aida represent them?
Yes, I think she has their strength and determination because they also tried to rescue their kids and they didn't succeed. And all these years after, they are very active in our society, seeking for truth and justice. And as I mentioned, they're still searching for mass graves. And they organize themselves into their shared solidarity among them. And also they are promoting idea that we have to live together again and that no nation is guilty for what happened. It's only individuals. They don't allow to say, you know, all Serbs committed genocide, which is, you know, sometimes what politicians use against other nation. They are always saying, no, there are perpetrators who should be in jail or they are in jail. And they always went to Den Haag to witness against them. So this force they had, I really wanted to integrate in Aida. When Aida goes back to Srebrenica, this is what I witnessed with many of these women, you know, that they are meeting perpetrators, they are meeting these people, and they still talk how people should live together. I think, you know, if they just said once, let's make revenge, I want to revenge my sons. And there are some of them which lost 60 members of family, you know, like all brothers, husband, brothers, nephews, all of them are gone. And there was not a single case that revenge happened or that they asked for it. They were always saying the opposite. We have to live together. Only those who committed crimes have to be in jail. And I'm always saying, can you imagine what this country would look like if they said, let's revenge our sons? I mean, we would still be flooding in blood.
You began our conversation saying that you began this whole project with the question, why didn't the United Nations help? Why didn't they fire a single bullet? Did you find out the answer to that?
Like every answer, it's not easy one. It's it has several layers. On one side, they were really abandoned by headquarters in New York and in other important political centers, you know, by France, by Great Britain, because at that time, 95, it was already fourth year of war and NATO and everybody wanted to finish the war. But on the other hand, United Nations on the ground, though they were not supported, were behaving differently in different areas. Problem with Dutch were that they had a lot of prejudice towards Muslims. They couldn't empathize with people. They just wanted to finish their mission and go home as soon as possible. And plus, they were very scared. It was not a group of brave men at all. But I'm talking about the past, but I want to talk about present as well with this film. If Srebrenica is happening today, I'm not sure anybody in Europe would care and that they would change something, that they would make any action to rescue people. This is what worries me about state of mind we are in.
So you think it is as it was back in the early 90s, this feeling of distrust or hatred for other ethnic groups? You think that that's back?
No, I think from Europe that European Union wouldn't react on the fact that people who are not European members of European Union and who are Muslims are being killed. I think no politicians would do any action against this fact. So my big wish is that people in Europe also see the film, in America, everywhere, that understanding what happens, because I, as I said before, I don't think it's an exclusively Balkan thing. I think we human beings behave more or less the same, and it could happen to anybody of us.
I want to thank you so much for coming on the show today.
Thank you so much. It's a pleasure to talk to you.
It was a great conversation. Thank you. That's Jasmila Zibanić, director of the new film, Quo Vadis, Aida. It's nominated for an Academy Award, and you can watch it now on Hulu. Well, our DJ, Valida, is also a Bosnian Muslim. And coming up, she's here to remember growing up during that war and how it shaped her life. That's next on Press Play. This is Press Play on KCRW. I'm Madeline Brand. Well, we just talked about the film Quo Vadis, Aida, the story of what happened in Srebrenica back in 1995 during the Bosnian War, when around 8,000 Bosnian Muslim men and boys were systematically executed, their bodies dumped into mass graves. I want to turn to a member of the KCRW family to talk about this, our DJ Valida. She's from Sarajevo. She moved to the United States in the early 90s during the war. Welcome to the program.
Thanks, Madeline, so much for having me.
Well, it's great to have you. Now, you are Bosniak. What did you think of this movie? Did it speak to you personally?
Of course. I mean, this tragedy is such a, God, I don't even know where to begin, but it's one of those things that links all Bosnians together, no matter where they are. And whether we were in Bosnia at the time or we were, like, I was in the United States, we all lived through the tragedy. Like, we lived vicariously through news. And those 4 years, and especially July of 1995, is one of those events that just completely shapes you as a person. There's like a before and then after.
So were you in Sarajevo during the attack there? Because the Serbs attacked Sarajevo for years.
Yeah, I left in my sister and mother and I left in fall of 91. My dad stayed behind. I guess there was so much in the air, and a lot of families were beginning to exit Sarajevo, those that could. And we thought it was only going to be for a few months. Nobody had any idea or clue that it would go on for as long. And of course, 3 months turned into 4 months, and then 4 months turned into 6 months. And then here I am 26 years later.
So you were here in the United States in 94.
Yeah, in January of 94.
The massacre took place in 95.
Yeah.
How did you find out about it?
Through the news. There were a lot of periods of time when communication with Bosnia was completely shut off. Like, there were no working phone lines. Sarajevo was under siege. So we relied on BBC and CNN. And every once in a while, like, my dad would somehow find, like, some sort of makeshift, like a radio frequency, like hum radio or something, and he would call. And also Soros opened a toll-free number for a number of months where Bosnians could call in and then connect with their loved ones in Sarajevo. So you could, every once in a while, you would get lucky and you could get through. But I watched a lot of it on TV, like most Bosnians who lived outside.
But it took years to really understand exactly what happened.
Oh, the proportions, of course. I mean, Srebrenica stands out as the biggest, but there were so many other smaller scale massacres that took place. The town that my dad grew up is another one that fell, Foča. And we heard of all the massacres that would happen, and women, children, men, it didn't even matter. It was some of the most horrific, systematic executions taking place. And it just the whole climate was like leading up to Srebrenica, but I guess because the numbers are so huge, no one understood until later what happened to all these men that were taken on the buses and never to hear from again.
Well, as we heard in the earlier segment with Jasmila, who was in Sarajevo, also grew up in Sarajevo, she never really thought about her Muslim background as being separate from the rest of the people. Like, everyone merged together. Everyone, Serbs, Croats, Muslims, they were all neighbors and friends, and no one really thought about each other's ethnic identities. How is it for you now? Do you think differently about your background?
That's a million-dollar question. There's so much debate in Bosnian culture and Bosnian media about the identity of Bosnians and who are Bosnians, what are our roots, and well, it's the reason why Jasmila is also speaking with, about not being aware is because we grew up in a socialist communist country, mm-hmm. and religion was not a big part of our life, but we did have this brotherhood that even I'm sure that Jasmila talked about. We just felt like we were part of one. And I like that. I didn't care who my friends were. Like, I had friends who were Christian and Muslim, and that's how it should be. I don't like dividing people by religion. However, because the way the war panned out, it just seems like some people weren't brought up like that because they were brought up with a lot of hate, which is what explains the massacres. Like, how do you kill 8,000 people unless you were indoctrinated to hate the other side?
Yeah. I understand on your show every year you commemorate the massacre.
Yes, I do. And I have a special song that I always play. It's by my dear friend, Alma Fedovic. And the song is just, it's in the tradition of Bosnian folk kind of music. Hmm. And it's just, it's a very kind of melancholy. And she just really paid the most beautiful tribute to the massacre.
Let's hear a little bit of that. It's called Srebrenica, and it's by Alma Fedovic. Aman Srebrenica.
Sviće nikog nema.
So haunting. What is she saying there?
Oh, she's talking about the innocence and hearing the screams and the tears. But it's so poetic, it's so beautiful that you just lose yourself in the beauty. But it's definitely about a call from the depths of the innocence and the quiet that precedes something of such a horrifying nature, like when everything kind of stops because the breathing stops.
Kraj kabura slike sjeća.
It's just, oh my God, just even hearing it now, I just die.
Well, Valida, thank you for coming on the show and bringing us that song and your memories of your time in Bosnia and Srebrenica. Really appreciate it.
You're so welcome, Madeline. Thank you so much for having me.
It's KCRWDJ, Valida. That'll do it for us here on Press Play. Thank you for listening. I'm Madeline Brand. I'll see you tomorrow.